time because he's got some good stuff to say, I know. This man has meant a lot in my sobriety since day one. I've known him since I've been sober. And I could bore you with a lot of details about how he has blessed my life. He sent people to Winston-Salem that have helped keep me sober. That's good enough to say, I think. He's going to talk to us about trends and challenges of the fellowship. And I've heard him talk a little bit about those sorts of things before. So I know it's going to be good. Help me welcome Tom I.
Well, thank you very much, folks. Linda told me to talk fast, and I will. It just won't sound like it. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, a member of Primary Purpose AA Group in Southern Pines, and my sobriety date's Groundhog Day of 57. And, shoot, man, I'm glad to still be alive. Never mind, it's over. Just showing up ain't bad for me. You could call what I'm going to do a lot of stuff. It's just like any old-timer in the program. They always want to talk about the old days, you know, and romance them and tell you how great it was and what you missed and all that kind of stuff. I tell you one thing. Anybody that romances the old days either wasn't there or got a poor memory. One or the other. It was so good, I couldn't have stood much more of it than I had. Is that my water, Jim? Yeah, okay. Man will still drink even if it's just water. He goes. So what I'm going to do is go through, been ordered to by Linda, and I obey women folk. I'm trained that way. And so I'm going to go for about a max of 45 minutes, then leave a little time for some interaction. And she said, make it 40 if you can, so I'll get going. And there are basically three things I'd like to talk about in this, is that there have been some real challenges and there are some trends in the program. So I want to look at it in three different segments. One is what we were like in those so-called old days that I'm sort of first person connected to or knew people who were. And then the second one is what happened that started to move us in a little bit different direction. Reflect on that a little bit, and then what we're like now. And so it's kind of like telling your story, only we're telling the story of fellowship in a way. When I say it was, there were some bad things, there were some awfully good things, but there were some things that I don't really miss a bit. Like telephone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't miss that a bit. I have not yearned for one. I can't say I haven't had one, but I tell you, I don't yearn for them. They were always interesting kind of things. They led to a lot of kinds of stuff. I've done 12-step calls in this town, and I lived here for a while and lived in Gastonia for even longer. And back then, the Mecca, the center for 12-step work in Charlotte, was the old Seventh and Church 12-step service club. And that was the focal point for 12-step work. And I've gotten some interesting in this city and some over in Gaston County for sure. When I came into North Carolina in 60, Gastonia had groups, and had was an operative term. You know, some days they were and some days they weren't. And when I hit the ground over there, man, I wanted to run. I went into a town, and I swear to God, first meeting I went to over there was the worst meeting I'd ever been to. I just got out of jail, but man, we had never had a meeting that bad in jail. If we had, somebody would have been in trouble. It was bad, and I really was tempted to run and hide in Charlotte and all that stuff, but instead I decided to stick around. And then, just like any place where A's just blooming and starting to happen, there were just an awful lot of situations. I'll just share just a few that generated from those things. I was a young guy then. I still am. I don't look it, but I'm still quite young. And I was just a real young fella. Every 12-step call I ever made, I had to spend most of the time convincing them that I was an alcoholic. They knew they were, for the most part. And they were really interesting kind of things, particularly when you don't know what you're doing. At least, tell you what, I could describe it better by saying just look in the book where there's a paragraph that describes all of the stuff that can happen on a 12-step call. Believe me, that is not editorial license. That is absolute fact. There isn't anything on that page that I haven't experienced at least once, and some of them far more than once. And really, really good fun thing. I'll just tell you about two that I called on a guy in a real nice neighborhood. He was probably a nice man under different circumstances. And he listened to me for a few minutes, and then I watched a change occur. We were in his home, and his pride of ownership started to come to the fore. And he realized he was getting verbally assaulted by a stranger. And he got mad, and I wouldn't leave. So he even got madder. So he wanted to attack me and did a decent job. But he got a butcher knife, and he started to come at me with the butcher knife, but when he swung it back, he knocked himself down. Now, I didn't touch him, you know. And here he was, he knocked himself down, he slid under the dining room table, and his wife came running in. "What'd you do?" I said, "Do nothing. If that fool ever gets out from under that table and he wants help, tell him to call me." So, real good fun times, you know. I'll just mention one more. I'd love to tell you about 100, but I'll just tell you one more. That really opened a door for some good stuff in Gastonia since I survived it. Got a call one night from a guy, and he was a kind of high roller, and I hadn't dealt with too many of them back then. And so I got him out, and it took me a little while to figure out all he wanted to do was get away from his wife so he could have a drink. And I always made it a standing rule. I usually carried booze with me back then because we didn't have any place to take folk. And I usually made it a cardinal rule that I wouldn't buy a guy a drink unless I was convinced that I couldn't help him. And then if I was convinced I couldn't help him, I'd buy him a drink. I'd spot him one. And so that night I wrestled with him till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And then I said, "Okay, fine, I give up. What's your favorite bootlegger?" And he told me it was one I didn't know. I thought I knew every one of them and had charge accounts at all of them in that county. But I didn't know that one. And so I went there, grungy place. I don't think I hung out in places that bad. It was really lousy. It looked different when you're sober. It looked like an opium den in Calcutta or something. Yeah. Drunks wall to wall. And so I go in with this guy. Guy sells him a bottle of something, but he ain't never seen a tax seal, I'll guarantee you. And he paid for it. And now you didn't raid bootleg joints in Gastonia. That's the major industry of that county. And that night they made an exception. And all at once, here came police cars from every direction. And here they come, stormtroopers in there attacking these limber bodies out here on the floor. And I'm standing there watching it, you know, looking like a young Ivy League student or something. And this one policeman kept looking at me, and finally he couldn't stand. He came over and he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, you wouldn't believe it." He said, "Well, try me." And I told him, he said, "You're right, I don't believe that." But he took me at my word. I mean, hey, it was not known much at that time. And lo and behold, he was so impressed with that, he gave me the liquor to take for the drunk. And from then on, he gave me hell. Every time they'd get a drunk in jail, tearing the place up, he'd say, "I know just the guy to call." You know? Now, I didn't know what that was, but that was an early model of CPC, Cooperation Professional Community, and they were cooperating a lot more than I cared for. And so, but those were characteristic of the days. You know, some people have some romantic notion that back in the old days we had a lot more heavy-duty program and we got into greater depth and we just did a wonderful job of working steps and doing the book. If we did, I never discovered it. We were so busy chasing drunks, we used the book to beat them over the head to get them in the car. And you didn't have time for a lot of think tanks and study groups and taking folks through the step. That was a nice theory. It didn't happen. And so we were busy, real busy with action. And there were a lot of things that about those old days that I hope to God we never get back. We have a chance of doing it, but I hope we never get there. I remember, for example, a 12-step call that didn't have a lot of them didn't have a happy ending, But I remember in sitting in that county holding a guy in my arms while he died. And as he died, there was no place I could think of to take him. If you take a drunk to jail, then it put or to hospital, then it put you in jail. And so I held that man while he died. I don't want to ever see those good old days again. It means a lot to me today that alcoholism is treated in a different kind of a way. I thought you were going to testify. Sometimes just people break into rapture and just start going. I don't like those good old days. Yeah, and that, among the memories there was, we had one place in the county where you could take an alcoholic for medical attention. And this is literally exactly the way it was. This physician practiced in his home, and you had to take the alcoholic around to the back door, to the kitchen door, and take him in the back door, and then the doc would come back and shoot him in the rump, and that was it. That was the sum total of everything that existed in that county. I'm very grateful that that's no longer the case. I'm also very grateful that there was at least him. At least there was something. So a lot of those things in those good old days were out of whack. You know, it's a strange thing. I've been to many, many meetings in that town when I was the only guy at the meeting. I mean, many times. Wonderful meetings. Never had a fight in a single one of them. Group conscience was a real snap. And it's also a weird position when I was a young, cute fella, and I was the only guy in town that was free enough and goofy enough to 12-step women. And that's an interesting activity. The caution is well placed that men work with men, women with women. I 12-stepped one woman, and then I never 12-stepped another one alone. I 12-stepped a ton of them. My mother has been on more 12-step calls than most members. My sister, girlfriend, hitchhikers, I mean anybody. As long as it's a female, she'd go with me. She wouldn't even know what I'm doing. But anyway, interesting kind of an activity. I don't want to see those. I'm glad to see some women come. A woman came in from California, John. Beautiful girl. And sober 10 years, God knows. Man, I thought my prayers are answered. They were. And I was so glad to see that. Thank God for California. It may be weird, but there's good progress come out of there. Anyway, that was the name of the game then. There were some things about it. You know, those were the ragged and rugged days of yore. There were some good things about it. There was a quality of fellowship second to none during that period. I believe in that period, I think there was something like a total of 12 groups in Charlotte and that one struggling thing in Gastonia. And so the groups were few and far between. If you wanted to make a lot of meetings, you had to do a lot of traveling. And it built a quality of fellowship that was enormously important, where when a group would start in a town, people from all the towns around come in, support, help this bunch get going. Real quality of fellowship. Used to do a thing, and unfortunately, I don't like to say used to, but it just doesn't happen anymore, except one place in this state. They had what they called intercity meetings, where the people in a group of cities in 12, 15 counties would come together on a monthly basis and bring food and have a good time. Wonderful fellowship. So there were some good things that generated from that kind of thing. So there were good days. There were things going, and then, of course, things changed. And so things started to change a little bit. We had some breakthroughs that some of which I was able to witness firsthand, like alcoholism. Alcoholism never was declared an illness, but somewhere right about the time when I came in AA in 57, right in that period right in there, the American Medical Association sort of cast friendly eyes on alcoholism as being like an illness. And it started a favorable kind of recognition that there was more to this than just a moral issue. It was decidedly a moral issue up to that point across the board. And so that started to at least make a crack in the door. And some things ensued from that were really priceless. They were priceless to see and to be a part of. Back then, there was the only thing that was even remotely looked like treatment around here was a place called Wilmoth. And if some people in Charlotte will know Wilma's out on Old 29. And the name, if you think about it, it's obvious where it came from. It's Wilmoth is Wilson Smith, our founders. And they named that facility. Now, all it was a tapering off place. But for $75, you could take an alcoholic over there. 3 days later, you'd have a sober guy. They just did graduated reductions in booze. They'd serve on a certain hour. And if you don't think drunks can tell time, you serve drinks on the hour. Hey, it's 9 o'clock. You got you. But it worked. And man, I tell you, I'm glad to spend that $75. It sure beat wrestling and getting, this stuff. So some stuff started to happen. The first place, I mentioned to somebody earlier today, that to my knowledge, the first place in North Carolina where a hospital allowed alcoholics, and I'm not talking about rich people who could buy the hospital and went in under gastrointestinal disturbance or something. I'm talking about showing up, walking around alcoholics. First place I know that they got put in was up in, ironically, in Sylvan, North Carolina. There was a place up there, and I happened to be up there one time. Somebody told me they were doing that. And sure enough, they were having alcoholics treated just like patients in that hospital, almost like patients. Only difference was we had to assign keepers, attendants. And so you had to go into a shift. They wouldn't let nurses have to wrestle them. Tell your wife about that. So you'd have to go and stand just like standing guard duty. And we did that in Gastonia. I went over there one night to relieve a guy, and he said, just like changing the guard, he said, he's doing fine. He's absolutely no problem. Guy's doing well. Be no problem whatsoever. I said, okay, great. So he left. I walked in, no drunk. And I said, where is that fool? And so I'm looking under the bed, in the bed, in the bathroom, and push his feet in the ceiling tile. Well, you never know what a drunk's going to do. I know he didn't come out that door. And the windows were only about that big, so I knew he didn't go out there. And then all of a sudden I heard a little bit of a clatter in the locker. That old metal locker? I heard a little clatter, and I said, oh, God. So I went over and opened the door. Well, he was only slightly confused. He thought he was in the bathroom at the urinal. And I said, what are you doing, fool? And he said, I beg your pardon. I said, pardon my... Get out. But anyway, goofy things. But the good news was that we were able to start treating this illness like an illness. And man, I was so thankful when we started to treat the illness with some dignity and consideration. Tremendously grateful. I never went through any of that myself, but man, I was deeply grateful when it started to happen. And there were places, finally, where these things started to come. A phenomenal thing happened in this country when these things started to happen. Third-party payment became a reality, where if it's a medical condition, then insurance companies started to provide coverage. It's an amazing thing what happens when you mix money and spirituality, I guess, or just when you introduce money. Strange things happen. This moral scourge of the nation became an illness, and treatment absolutely started and exploded in this country. I would never have believed it had somebody told me that I would see a day when alcoholism, one thing, it was a major plank in a presidential election in the platforms of both parties, that alcohol and drug were major platform planks. I would have never believed that. And along in that same time is that the treatment explosion occurred. And realistically, treatment was available almost on demand anywhere in this country. I would have never believed that. But that wasn't beyond a dream come true. That was a vision realized. I could not imagine. And so some wonderful stuff. I was absolutely delighted when that happened, even though I'd never been through it. I value that. And I know that for many people, it's made an enormous difference. But as these things started to happen, there's some baggage associated. There always is. You know, good news always had a little bad news with it. And so there were some things that started to happen. I want to just touch on these a bit. Let me preface it first by saying that anything I say that sounds critical, I mean, I won't apologize for it, but if it sounds critical, I don't mean it in a negative way. It's just a way of observing the things that happen. I'll tell you one thing I'll also preface it with is that there is no problem in Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't happen on my watch. None of them were inherited. All of them happened while I was on duty. And so I take responsibility for it. And as a matter of fact, most of the negative impacts that occurred in this program, I honestly believe were self-imposed by us. By us. By how we reacted to stuff. And so when treatment started to work, to emerge, yeah, I think there was pretty widespread gratitude for that. The fact that it was in place and that it was there. And then it's amazing how quickly the honeymoon ends. And then some strange things started to occur in our fellowship where we sort of copped an attitude about that. We copped an attitude about the emergence, and I say we, globally speaking, that there were some people that were true devotees. My buddy was chairman of the board of a well-respected treatment facility. There were many people who really rallied to the cause and recognized an important emergence in our society. But there were troubling things, you know, and I think one of the things that happened when treatment emerged would be, for example, if alcoholics were coming in that door, that's what we were used to. We were used to greeting them there, and we had a protocol for how we dealt with them when they came in. When treatment emerged, they started coming in that door. But we're still watching that door and grousing and grumbling because they're coming in from somewhere else. And you started hearing at first glee that, man, we've got an awful lot of new people coming in here. And then we started getting some grousing. And we started hearing stuff like, what is this treatment thing? They're doing the same thing we do, and yet they're charging money for it. You started hearing stories about the $10,000 big book, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And so we started to get an attitude about this, and It just increased over time, so that you got a not too widespread. Well, I mean totally widespread, but not universal, where there was negative feelings and negative attitudes. We had groups in this state, not California, in this state, that made formal requests to treatment centers to don't send those people here. Now, that's quite far removed, isn't it, from the old watchword of that I need the new alcoholic more than he needs me. When I make a 12-step call, it can't lose because I come out sober. That's pretty far removed when we start getting into a posture and say, don't bring those people here. You know, I had a guy in my home group, to bring it a little closer home, in my home group, I sponsored him. I wasn't proud of it that day. But he said in the meeting with some treatment center patients sitting at the table, these people can't be sincere under those conditions. Well, my God, man, you know, come on. You know, and when we get to a point where we're starting to feel this kind of negativity, there's something extremely dangerous about that. Something dangerous about that for us. And so we started to get that kind of a thing. We started to get sort of party line stuff. It was often quoted that we overrated treatment sometimes. You'd hear it said in our ranks that treatment is equivalent to anywhere from 1 to 5 years of recovery. And there was a kind of a widespread notion that that was true. Because somebody would come out of treatment and they'd learned a whole new language and they were articulate about the illness and how to say stuff. What we overlooked is that treatment has nothing to do with recovery. Treatment is an intervention where a patient can be brought to a point where they may be amenable to recovery. may be prepared to engage in recovery. When somebody leaves the treatment center, what we fail to recognize was that that is day one of recovery, day one. And it's a whole new world. It's one thing to move from a clinical cocoon into a place where you got to be willing to fight the fight of your life. And so it's a tenuous, challenging journey through that thing. And so we started to get that overrated. We thought just because somebody could talk nice that they were just ready to be president of AA or sponsors or anything, you know, instead of treating them like what they were, brand new people in recovery. We started to have a huge explosion of meetings that, you know, you could pretty well go to the bank on it. If a treatment center opened in a city, the number of AA meetings would double almost overnight. I don't mean literally overnight, but it would very quickly double the population of AA groups in a city. And on the face of it, that looks good. But then when you look a little closer, you know, we started to see the development of groups that were essentially one, or meetings that were essentially one-dimensional, meaning that they were primarily about recovery, and where all too often the topic of the meeting was the problem of the day, you know, who's got a problem, and this kind of stuff. And it started to generate so that it was a kind of a new breed of AA meeting, in that it was almost like an aftercare group, you know, where you start talking about the problem and romancing the problem in the early stages of recovery. And it probably has some utility, but it had an enormous change on the demographics of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we started to see these meetings. All too often, these meetings would be generated at times of utmost convenience. We started to see a lot of morning meetings, a lot of noon meetings, a lot of any time of day meetings, happy hour meetings, so you drive home on the way from work and don't have to change clothes. They're all nice, reasonable things. But it has a real impact when you start looking at the fabric of AA. And so what you have is these things, they're very popular. God knows these things are popular. And they are hugely available in the United States of America. I'll tell you this, just in anticipation of my punchline, I consider that the biggest problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there are a lot of problems that I have concerns about, but that is probably the number one problem. Because what we have now is a proliferation of those kind of sort of one legacy type meetings and home groups where strong purposeful groups are becoming almost an endangered species. There are towns where there really aren't any. There are fairly large communities in this country where there are no open speaker meetings. I mean none. Now, I would submit to you that there's a significant landmark associated with what I just said. Our party line has always been that alcoholism is a family illness. It was demonstrated by you and Kara. That alcoholism is a family illness. Well, if it's a family illness, wouldn't it follow that our program is a family recovery program? If you've got meetings that are one legacy in orientation, where does the family get in? How does a family ever become a part of what's going on? What does a family, well, what it does is effectively block out the family from participation. And it either is a family illness or it isn't. You know, we, by the way, happen to have a divorce rate that's a little above the national average. So it's, I think, a very significant kind of a problem. I'll tell you what that looks like in real life to me. I was in a convention in another state a while back. It was interesting about the numbers that you've heard numbers announced here. At this particular convention, there were 3,200 people in attendance. Now listen to the numbers. There were 3,200 alcoholics, AA members. There were 240 members of Al-Anon. Is that a real nice, juxtaposition for a family illness and a family recovery. There were 41 or 2 Alateen. Now, I think there are real ramifications for that. You know, in early recovery, I can't spend too much time because Linda will fret. There are real ramifications for that in that in early recovery, if you were anything like me, a big night out was a Saturday night open speaker meeting. That was the big night out. And my God, for many couples in early recovery, that's all they could afford. And so it was a social life. It was a place for families to meet. It was a place for families to get understanding of the illness. To start, my wife, for example, till we married, she'd never been around. I was sober a long time when we married. And she never saw any need for Al-Anon. Yeah, I kind of wish she'd go, and she caught on, and then she wouldn't have gone with a bullwhip when she found out that's what I wanted her to do. But she went with me to open speaker meetings a lot. Even though she'd never been around active alcoholism, she developed a love for the people who have it. She's great. Absolutely great. I've been trying to get her to speak for 40 years. The girl won't speak to anybody but me about what I ought to do, you know. But after 3 years of attending open meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, she's now a strong member of Al-Anon. Never had any notion. She believes, but she's heard enough stories from people who were observers. She believes I had it. And she's a fine, fine person. She does more work with the people I sponsor than I do. They deliberately call when they know I'm gone because they'd rather talk to her than me. And she does great work. But see what I'm talking about? That's one of the things that shifted. You know, anyway, that is a whole volume to go with that, but these were changes that were starting to occur in this fellowship. I shouldn't write notes in a hurry because I might have to read them. One product of it, and I've just alluded to it a little bit earlier, is that We developed a genuine complacency about this active outreach. That's what the world would call it, but this active outreach in Alcoholics Anonymous. Of acting on this notion that I need the alcoholic more than he needs me. I still say to every new person who walks into my group, if I get a chance to get hold of them, and I usually do, that they'll start to thank me for something, and I'll say, no, don't thank me. I need you more than you need me. I know they never believe that. I just pray that I believe that. That's fundamental. If I get to thinking I'm just some dispenser of goodness or some such junk, man, it's all over. It's all over. And so we started to lose this need to go get them. Why would you? Because we started to get people just delivered to Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't have time. We should be unloading the bus. Didn't have time to go get more. And that created an interesting problem. I got a call one day from a guy. They started a group, and they made a mistake when they named it. They called it the Newcomer Group. Well, that's music to the ear of a treatment center. My God, what more would you want? So they started this group, and they'd met 4 or 5 times. And so he called me, and I said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, we've got an awful lot of people coming in from the treatment center. I said, my God, man, that's no problem. And I said, that's my manna from heaven. He said, yeah, it is. But how do we give coffee to these folk? There were 4 guys in the group. And a bus pulled in the night before with 41 patients from a... Well, some interesting fiscal and logistical difficulties involved in that. And so, see, that sense of being overwhelmed. And so just the result of this kind of onslaught of new people coming from a new place through that door sort of hair-lipped the fellowship a bit. And so we started to get backed off. Right now, well, I don't know about this crowd. This is probably a way above average crowd. But in the average crowd in AA, probably 75 to 80% of the members couldn't define what CPC means. I was sitting in a service workshop at a convention somewhere, and I asked a question about something to do with CPC, and a woman stood up and said, "Can I ask a question of the questioner?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." And she said, "I hate to ask this. I'm embarrassed to ask this, but because I've been sober 22 years, what is CPC?" And I said, "Dear, don't you be embarrassed, because you're speaking on behalf of three quarters of the fellowship. What is CPC?" We've used that so little, it's almost gone into obscurity. And rather than being a vibrant force where we engage with the world around us so that alcoholics who hit the wall will know where to go, what we've done is just said, "Don't need to. We don't need to." Let me tell you the result of that. That's, how am I doing, Linda? I knew you stuck your head out there. That's not Linda. She had a hard night. She I know. I used to look like you. Hope you got a sense of humor. You're bigger than me. Well, what? God, don't stick hillbilly on me. But what happened with that thing is that we quit doing that stuff, and there's some real bad byproducts of that thing. And the example I wanted to give you is this. Like, right now, I guarantee you in this crowd, if I ask you right now to name, let's rip off 25 names of people in the early history of Alcoholics Anonymous, non-alcoholic public leaders who were visibly, vocally, publicly supportive of what we were trying to do in AA. I guarantee you we could name them in less than 5 minutes. Then if I followed that with a question and said, "Well, let's name a few today," you'd get the message. Because that's what the answer would be. But when we quit trying to cooperate with our friends go away. Our friends have stuff to do. And when we don't establish that cooperative relationship, guess what? There is none. I'll tell you this. For the first time in my recovery, there's some troubling qualities to this. Man reported to me just something he run into. He went to a dock up in our capital in Raleigh. He went to a dock that he knew and told him he was in AA and that just wanted him to know if he had any patients that had alcoholism to feel free to call him. And the doc, being a courteous man, said, "I really appreciate your coming, but I found a better solution." That's not an unusual response today. I'll tell you my honest belief. It doesn't make it right, but it's my honest belief that today we have the lowest level of respect in the professional community that I've ever seen. And I don't think it's because they don't like us or anything like that. I think it's just that we haven't carried out that part of the cooperative relationship. And so things like CPC and PI and things like that try to get pushed into an interesting but unimportant category. I would suggest that they are really vitally important things, vitally important. But it's just one of the many things that come about that. I'll have to finish on this one because she's getting really testy. Just one other thing. It ties to some issues that I know everybody's concerned about, that it's what I'd call inappropriate referrals to AA. And of course, I don't know of any place on earth that it's not a factor. And I'll give you this example, and it's a way you can do something about it. and a recognition I think we have to have. That in my home group, the one right before the one I'm in for the last 10 years, a fellow came to me one night and said, Tom, we need to do a group inventory. Now, that's an unusual request. And I said, what for? And he said, well, we're getting too many addicts in here. And I'm not totally unobservant, but I get busy and sometimes I don't notice stuff, you know, and I don't catch on real quick. And he told me what he's talking about. And I said, well, let me take a look, see if I see the same. And what it was there was a juvenile capturing facility over here where they tried to fence in wild young hellions. What they were doing, a lot of them had our problem and some others as well. And so what they're doing was bringing them over to our group. And you know, I said a while ago that most of our wounds are self-imposed. What was happening in our zeal to make those kids feel welcome, we were asking them to participate in the meeting by giving out chips and reading and stuff like that. You know, fail to observe that AA meetings are conducted by AA members, period. Period. And we got away from that. We were trying to be nice, and we wound up doing a disservice. And so I saw what it was. We had a little meeting, and they asked if somebody would go over and talk to the folk at that facility. And they strangely nominated me. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll go. So I went over there. Nice young lady, MSW lady, nice lady. And she had never heard of a closed meeting. They don't teach that in MSW programs. Where would she learn it? You know, nobody had ever bothered to tell her. We just assumed that she should know because we know. And so I explained to her what the closed meeting was, what an open meeting was. She said, oh, well, we'll take care of that. Now, I knew better than that. I've tried to herd goats before, and that is hard work. And so, that was fine, you know, and we had a friend there. We didn't make an enemy. We created a stronger friend. And then we set up a newcomer meeting. And we made it open deliberately so that there would be a place where people could not only get a strong introduction to AA, but could also sort out their stuff. Those kids didn't know what they were, for God's sakes. They're kids. They didn't know if they're alcoholics or goats. They had no clue. They were just crazy kids. And they had to sort stuff out. So we did that. And that group and the group I'm in now for the last 25 years, we have had two problems, dealing with addicts in meetings. In fact, both of those were caused by one of our members, caused both of them. It's somebody that just didn't know how to talk to people without being abrasive. And so it's a wonderful way to take a problem and create a solution. And my God, in my group right now, the newcomer program is the strongest thing in it. We'll average anywhere from 25 to 40 plus people every week. Wonderful place to introduce people to AA. So sometimes I'm not through, but I'm going to quit anyway. I will. I got a bunch of other stuff, but I also got Linda breathing heavy. That's not a good way to put that. I got Linda on my mind. I'll put it that way. Talk to me a little bit. Talk to me. Anybody, come on up and have at it. Oh, watch her. She's coming fast.
I'm Jesse. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Jesse. One thing that you didn't mention, yeah, but I think you would. You talked about all the changes that came about as a result of the 70s and 80s proliferation of treatment centers. And, of course, what's happened now in the last 10 years as a result of reverse in all those reimbursement policies. Now 80% of these places have gone out of business, and what I hear a lot of in AA is, well, now we don't have all these people coming into AA that we were getting from treatment centers. You know, mm-hmm. We're not growing as fast, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All that stuff happened, and then it kind of quit. Mm-hmm. And that caused for another adjustment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry about the mic thing. Mike's broke. Yeah, we'll go on without that. There'll be what? Yeah, no, what Jesse's talking about, in case you couldn't hear it, he's talking about that. Yeah, so the treatment centers are going away, and what happens because the numbers are not going up in AA. And I'll tell you something in relation to that, Jesse, to maybe emphasize your point, that I mentioned something that happened for the first time in my history. Three or four years ago, something like that, I was sitting in the assembly, the state, in our area assembly in Raleigh, and for the first time in my recovery, I listened to the statistical reports, the financial reports, and all of the stuff that we get from our national headquarters. Every single number in AA was down for the first time in my recovery. I'm talking about a membership, groups, finances, literature. If we count it, it's down. A couple years later, I was in a panel up in Chicago, and our Class A trustee and two delegates were there. And I mentioned that in the, just under the mic and said, is there any change in that, the same, better, or worse? And the Class A guy, the non-alcoholic guy, raced to the mic, and he said, I'm eager to answer that question. He said, I wish I had good news, but I don't. Every number is either the same or down. So you're right. In the real world, we would call that a recession. In AA, we tend to not notice it. But when we've got a downcline, everything else in this world is going up. Population is going up. Ours is going down. I think there's a real message in that. And so there is something there. What we're obviously going to have to do is reactivate those deals. That's one of the reasons that I beat this drum a lot. Because I don't want to see us become a weaker fellowship. I don't want to have less friends. I want to have more friends. This illness is not getting better. It's getting worse. And so I think we're going to have to reactivate those active outreach programs, like we don't call them that, but that's what they are, you know, where we reach out. And you know, my watchword is this, and I would offer it to you and hope you'll share the zeal. I believe that every place that alcoholics hit the wall, and God knows that's everywhere, every place that hit the wall, there ought to be somebody there who's equipped to tell them where they can go to get help. And they don't teach that in universities. My son's a physician. He learned more in AA than he ever learned in medical school. He had about a total of 5 hours, I think, in medical school. And so it's a huge problem. It's a really, really big problem. And so I hope that we will. Look at that in your community. If the people who intercept drunks when they hit the wall are not equipped, for God's sakes, equip them. It doesn't take a master's to do it, just to do it. Yeah, but yeah, it is a troubling gray zone, Jesse. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. Noel County alcoholic. I have some sponsees in another town, and grand sponsees who are very concerned about their home group meeting, which long-standing meeting, lots of old-timers, but they're all saying now, well, we've already done it, so it's time for somebody else to do it, but they're also not getting their sponsees involved in the service work to Alcoholics Anonymous. Could I get your insights on the old-timers who are just saying, I'm tired of doing it?
Sometimes you got 12-step to old-timers, I guess. I tell you, I don't envy any of those folk that, you know, when you stop doing it, you pay the price. You know, I'm 74 years old, and I've been doing it for 50 years, and I'll guarantee you I'm more charged up today than I was then. And I'll guarantee you I don't see many people sitting around staring at their navel and checking their pulse every 30 minutes that I want to emulate. And so it's a bad message. It's a bad message that old-timers can make an awful lot of a contribution. My baseline belief is, and it doesn't make it widespread, but I believe that the spirit of enthusiasm, of joy, of the pink cloud lasts as long as you do the things that make it happen. And when you quit, if you want to settle for mediocrity or whatever you settle for, it's there for you. Yeah, but that's my message to old timers. Man, you step back, it's your loss. It's your loss. Otherwise, I don't know, just sort of gang up on the new ones and try to get them 12-step them. But you're right, though. I see that a lot. Yeah, Amin. Yeah.
My name is Amin. Hey, I'm an alcoholic.
Amin.
I asked this question of my sponsor, but he suggested that this would be the appropriate forum to ask it.
He passes the buck.
Cooperation with the professional community and public information. Successful models that have been successful in developing a good working relationship with the professional community. Can you talk about some of those models and what we can do to improve our relationship with the institutions, specifically the institutions in the court and the institutions in the prison?
Thank you, Amin. I'm glad to talk about it. I'm better at talking about the negative than the positive. let me start with the negative, though. Where's Newton here? Oh, there he is. I've already laid this on him one time, but I want to repeat it and then get a massive group conscience to converge on him and say, now you go take this message. Newton's our delegate. And we're getting ready to spend $65,000. Is that what it is? $65,000? Somewhere right in that neighborhood, give or take. What's that to a rich guy? That is devoted to creating a video, DVD or something, for corrections people as a CPC effort. Well, what I said to Newton, and I want y'all to join me in this now, let's gang up on him, and that is the biggest waste of money that I could imagine. Because establishing working relationships with people doesn't mean send them a movie. You imagine how much we're barraged with information every day, 24 hours a day. You imagine how much impact you're going to have with an 8-minute video thing. You imagine how many people are even going to watch it. And if they do, what will happen? I can tell you. I was one of those for 39 years, and I can tell you the impact on that will be zilch, zilch. But, see, a lot of time we look at CPC as going somewhere and making a speech or, you know, taking the literature and setting it down. I think it's a much more aggressive, active term. Cooperate, for me, simply means one thing, is how do you cooperate? How do you figure a way to work together? You know, and that's what it's about, is how to reach people, like the example I gave where people hit the wall. Cooperate would be to go and meet with that staff, find out who they are, meet with them, and say, when they hit the wall and you want somewhere to call, let me tell you where to call. Let me tell you how you can connect with us. You know, that's cooperation. We did it. I won't have time to graph it, but we did it with a little small meeting we had earlier. We did it with this court slip kind of thing. And in our little old community down there, in Mayberry, it's easy to fix stuff. No, it's not either. It's the same thing. But I was bugged by that for a long time. And so we talked about that. We set up some strategies, met with the probation folk, offered them a better solution. They bought it 100%, and we haven't had a slip of paper in our group for something like 6 years. And I am so grateful to be able to say, if people ask me, are you still getting people from probation? I am so glad to be able to say, I don't know. It's none of my business where folks come from, for God's sakes. I couldn't care less. I'm just glad they come. And so that's one, you know, where you could just find a problem and then address it. You know, I think a lot of those problems are soluble. If we'll just reach out to folk and say, how can we come together? I'll just tickle you a little bit with this, but there's a little bit of preliminary conversation going on with what I call the drunk lawyer program. It's not only the people at the lower level of the food chain, there are people at every level of the food chain who are captured in sort of dead-end street programs. And so what's going on is a little bit of conversation with the state-level people who take care of capturing and monitoring lawyers to the grave. Most to no avail, by the way, and seeing if you can't offer something better. I can't tell you how hungry the people are at the state level for something that will offer cooperation. And I won't have time to elaborate on this, but But what's really happening, I believe, is that when we step back, when treatment emerged, and we step back and got more complacent, the people, these are well-intended people. These are not mean people. These people stepped in and made up for our absence by extending their reach into the recovery process. They did it in our absence. And so what I'm advocating is that we step up to our partnership in that role. And so I think there are just thousands of ways to do it. Some are successful. I guarantee you the day we say let's meet to the bar people, they will jump to the table. They are eager to do something. Got some folks working on docs right now. They don't know we're working on them, but they'll find out one day. They'll be had. Stuff like that. And there are a lot of others, but I think the key thing is that there isn't a person in this room that can't do some CPC work as soon as you get home. In fact, you could do it at the lobby of this hotel. I guarantee you the folks at this hotel will see more drunks in the next month than you will. I mean, I show enough ones that are drunk. They're going to see a lot of them. They'll see some that would be good to put in touch with AA. They don't know that. They don't know how to do that unless we tell them. So the opportunities are everywhere. Last one, I think. Anybody? Yes, Cliff. Well, I said last one. Yielding to the beauty. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm John.
Hey, John.
And in the beginning, you talked about when you make 12-step calls, and you said that sometimes in California, you know, that we men sponsor women and so on. And I just want to mention to you that I am from the south of Los Angeles, and I was speaking out at Brentwood in West L.A. one time in the workshop there, and I said, I know where I'm coming from, men sponsor women, and women, men sponsor men, and women sponsor women.
I knew you'd get that right.
Practicing all the time up here, yeah. But I have made this observation that I've never seen a guy up here who sponsors an old ugly broad.
Way to go, John. Come on, Cliff, right quick like. Thank you, John. John is just loaded with wisdom, and he's my good buddy.
I
got it. Yeah.
I was wondering if you've seen any correlation between some of this lack of connection with the proliferation of open discussion meetings, getting away from speaker meetings, getting away from the book, getting away from, you know, kind of going along with the decline in the recovery rate that it talked about in the second edition forward.
Let me hit it, Dad, because I think we've got to quit. And the I see more than a correlation. I see a direct connection to it, direct. Part of what's troubling about those things, they are one-dimensional. And when you think, if you think beyond just your immediate present, you know, the immediate concern, think about who our next delegate will be, where he'll come from. Where does our leadership come from? You know, you don't develop leadership in a meeting where you're just talking about me and my comfort. You know, and so you're not going to get the leadership. You're not going to get the strength. You're not going to get a seasoned group conscience about things. And so when you start, I think there's a real correlation in that, because those won't happen in little cases. The problem with those kind of meetings is that the only value is the meeting itself, unless there's just some casual association. But there is nothing that precedes it or follows it. It's a group of people who come together, may have a nice time, but that's all there is to it. And that's just not enough. We've got far too complex a situation. And beyond that, I'll talk a little bit more about it tonight, but getting into these things is what lights up your life. This is what makes sobriety a thrill rather than just a drag. Thanks a lot, folks.